Well, they can afford to be choosy, the article says, because jobs in their area in the Middle Atlantic are plentiful. They quote one high school student named Tom who had turned down a $5 an hour internship at the courthouse to take an $8 to $10 an hour job doing construction. Everyone can get a job, says young Tom. You just pick your first choice. Sometimes you don't even have to go looking for a job. The jobs come looking for you. Megan, a high school junior, tells of how she was sitting on the front steps of the library when a man from the local shoe store came by and said he needed someone to work for him. Megan declined the offer because she already had another job. Well, those are only two anecdotal examples. Not every section of the country shares in this good fortune. In Texas, for instance, teenage unemployment tops 20%. One expert in demographics predicts that it's only a matter of time before the experiences of young people like Megan and Tom spread across the entire country. The high employment today that's found in New England, California, and the Mid-Atlantic are, he says, the wave of the future. Well, as employers will be the first to tell you, the problem isn't just finding people. It's finding people with the necessary skills. And that's what Bill Brock is talking about when he refers to Workforce 2000, that the workers between now and the turn of the century have the skills requisite for the jobs being created. And the reason we can celebrate job power today is our growing economy, an economy liberated by tax cuts, deregulation, and declining inflation. This month of October marks the 59th straight month in our economic expansion. And as of November, we'll have broken all U.S. records for the longest peacetime expansion in history. Not only is it the longest, it's one of the strongest, too. Since began, our gross national product has risen some 20%, well above that of comparable expansions. We've been creating jobs at an average rate of almost a quarter of a million a month, as Bill told us, for a total of nearly the 14 million new jobs, as you've seen. And we're not just creating more jobs, we're creating better jobs. According to Labor Department data, nearly two-thirds of the new jobs have been in the higher-paying occupations, and we've seen that here now in the charts, with only 12% in lower-paying, low-skill occupations. Over 90% of the jobs are full-time. In short, we're talking about continuing job creation with jobs that are better paying, more challenging, safer, and more rewarding. So much for the so-called McJobs thesis. One of the groups that has benefited most from this job surge is, as we've been told, the black community. Employment of blacks has increased twice as fast as employment of whites. Since 1982, the real income of black families, as we've been told, has increased almost 40% faster than white family income. And the share of black families in the highest income bracket is up by over 70%. This August, the percentage of blacks employed was the highest on record, as was the percentage of all Americans employed. Economics columnist Warren Brooks looked at this record and concluded that, and I'll quote, on every front, jobs, income, even household wealth, this 1981 through 1986 has been the best five economic years in black history. Well, so far I've concentrated on employment, but that's only one indication of the strong and vital economy that we have today. I could talk about how inflation is holding low and steady, how real household income is way up, how manufacturing productivity has surged ahead well above the post-war average, and industrial production has outpaced Europe and Japan. All of this is concrete evidence of an economy that is strong and fundamentally sound. It's an economy judged in pure economic terms that has a very bright future before it, a future of growth, low inflation, and high employment. We've seen in the last week, however, that there's real concern on Wall Street. The recent turbulence in the stock market suggests that those who are investing in the future of our economy are worried that something, some roadblock, may be put in the way of that future. The market is constantly reacting to an almost infinite flow of information. There may have been hundreds of factors affecting the uneasiness on Wall Street, but I think it's appropriate to single out some of the more likely ones. The first are domestic, and I think it's fair to say primarily political in origin. I say political because they had more to do with the actions and lack of action of the government than with American business people, entrepreneurs, and workers. As I said, the business of America is sound. The economy is strong. Those who have to make the decision on whether or not to invest in the future of our economy see some very disturbing signs on Capitol Hill. For one, a dangerously protectionist trade bill working its way through conference. If passed, that bill would threaten a spiraling trade war and could very well bring our economic expansion to an end. And if it comes to that, I'll have no choice but to veto it. The devastating effect on... The devastating effect on employment, on all those jobs I mentioned, would only be a part of the effect of protectionist trade legislation. Of the roadblocks that could be thrown in the way of our economic expansion, Wall Street knows protectionism is one of the worst. At the same time, we see a Congress that's unable to get control of deficit spending. It backed away from its Graham-Rudman promises. And there are many who, while refusing to cut spending, insist on increasing taxes. The disruption in our markets is sending a signal loud and clear to get our economic house in order. And that's why last night I called for the bipartisan leadership in Congress to meet with me on Tuesday to arrange the process for reducing the federal deficit. And as I said, I will listen to them, but they must listen to me on the need to send a clear signal that spending will be restrained. And I'm asking every member of Congress who agrees that we should reject protectionist legislation, every member who agrees that tax increases are not the solution, to join with me in showing our support for America and her economic future. As I've said, I think the markets are reacting more to the actions and inactions of government than to the deficit itself, which has been shrinking, down nearly 30% since the last fiscal year. But while that deficit exists, the uneasiness will remain. And that's why we're going back to Congress, and in light of what's happened, redouble our efforts to cut the deficit by cutting away overspending. Congress has made no effort to seriously restrain domestic spending. Just freezing spending at last year's levels would yield substantial deficit reduction. Overspending endangers our economy. And each one of those cherished special interest programs is going to have to justify itself against the good of the whole nation. But let me just close with a message to all those in government. The story of this historic 59-month expansion is first and foremost, as you've heard up here today, a study of individual achievement, of the historic struggle of, or the heroic struggle of entrepreneurs, the hard work and dedication of laborers, the ingenuity and creativity of our business community, and just the plain raw power of American industry. All that's asked of us is not to get in their way, to keep the business environment as free and as stable as possible. Freedom and stability, that's all our economy needs. That's all Americans need to keep this economy growing well into the next decade. A little example of that was sent to me by a man the other day who's an eminent scholar, speaks fluent Russian. He was on a trip to Moscow, and he told me that in the cab, driving to the airport, had a young cab driver there, got into conversation with him. The young man was getting educated, going to school, but driving a cab to make that possible. And the scholar said, well, what are your plans? What do you intend to do? The young man said, I haven't made up my mind yet. Well, by coincidence, when he got to Moscow and got in a cab there, he had a young cab driver. And speaking Russian, he got into a conversation with him and found out he, too, was going to school as well as working. And he said, well, what do you intend to do, to be? And the young man said, they haven't told me yet. That's the difference. That's why freedom is the most important thing. But now, before I go, there are a few special American workers that I want to mention. Recently, the country was riveted, as you know, all of us, to the story of tiny Jessica McClure. And I think that we all said prayers of thanks when that story had a happy ending. And I think we're also very thankful in our hearts for the generous people who worked around the clock through fatigue, past exhaustion, to save little Jessica. And, of course... That's why I'm happy, and I think we all are, that three employees of the Department of Labor who work for the Mine Safety and Health Administration are here with us today, having done their job so well. Wayne Kanak is the manager of the Southwestern Division. When he heard of Jessica's plight, he called on the two best people he could think of, Dave Lilly and Sid Kirk, both experienced hard rock miners. Working closely together, they directed the rescue operation, drilling a hole parallel to the well and then digging a shaft across to reach Jessica. In fact, Dave Lilly chipped away by hand the last few inches of rock to make the first physical contact with little Jessica. Now, I know another Midlander. Vice President Bush has awarded you a certificate of recognition. And Wayne and Dave and Sid, I think you've understood here already this morning that we're all very proud of you.
And so the president applauds the three Labor Department members who played a significant role.